The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
I think we're all settled now. My name is Christine Haight Farley, and I'm delighted to welcome you here tonight. I'm the Associate Dean for Faculty and Academic Affairs at the Washington College of Law, and it is my great honor to be the first to address you. I want to welcome you to this event that we are so proud of. This is the third annual lecture on international commercial arbitration. We're pleased to see that the annual lecture has become a noteworthy event in Washington, D.C., a location that has become increasingly interested in and associated with international arbitration. As many of you are aware, international arbitration is a legal practice area posing diverse and unique challenges to legal practitioners all over the world, and has become recognized as the dispute resolution method for international commercial disputes. The International Arbitration Program was developed in 2004 at the Washington College of Law to prepare, under the direction of Horacio Gregoria Neon, to prepare the legal profession to face these challenges by identifying and addressing transnational legal issues that arise within the dynamic field of international commercial arbitration through academic offerings that provide critical legal skills. In essence, our aim is to bring together leading practitioners and academics from the United States and abroad to share ideas and experiences that specifically contribute to the task of preparing the legal profession in this burgeoning area of law. We are pleased to report that the program has established a strong academic reputation in the arbitration realm, and WCL has become known as one of the leading educational institutions on the topic. In October 2007, before delivering the second annual lecture, Dr. Julian Liu QC pointed out that what WCL had achieved in just a few short years was remarkable. Now in its third year, the annual lecture has become one of the program's premier events. The annual lecture offers an eminent figure in international arbitration, a platform on which to share his or her ideas on novel issues and current trends in international arbitration with practitioners in an academic forum. We are extremely pleased to have the Honorable Sir Vivian Ramsey delivering this year's annual lecture on the topic, Establishing Claims for Damages, Costs, and Interest in International Arbitration. Before Horacio formally introduces our renowned guest lecturer, I want to take a moment to offer special thanks to Thielen LLP for their continued sponsorship of the annual lecture. As you may know, Thielen is an international law firm and is widely known for premier practices in the areas of construction and government contracts, energy and utility, corporate finance, commercial litigation, and China securities and M&A. With offices throughout the globe and a combined history of over 80 years, Thielen has served a distinguished roster of clients, including many Fortune 500 companies, leading privately owned enterprises, public institutions, and partnerships. Thielen recently received the 2008 Chambers Award for Excellence in Construction Law, and its construction practice was described in the 2008 Client's Guide to America's Leading Lawyer for Business as the preeminent practice of its kind in the United States. We are pleased and honored to have Thielen's interest and support in the area of international commercial arbitration. We are thrilled that they have honored us by contributing resources to support this year's annual lecture, and we look forward to continued collaboration between the law firm and our law school as we work toward enhancing our academic activities in arbitration and creating new opportunities for our students and alumni. At this time, I would like to invite Barbara Werther, who is the managing partner at Thielen's DC office, to please come forward so that we can offer you a small token of our appreciation. Thank you.
Thank you, everyone. Thielen, of course, is very proud and honored to be sponsoring this auspicious lecture by Sir Vivian Ramsay. We're delighted. Thank you all so much.
Thank you, Ms. Werther. Allow me now to introduce the Director of the International Arbitration Program at WCL and Distinguished Practitioner in Residence, Dr. Horacio Gregaria Neon. Dr. Gregaria Neon is an independent international arbitrator and consultant on business and international law matters. He is a former Secretary General of the International Court of Arbitration, of the International Chamber of Commerce, and has been a practitioner in the field of international commercial arbitration and international business law for over 25 years. I think he began practicing when he was 10. Dr. Gregaria Neon is also a member of the American Law Institute, a former special counsel with White & Case, and former senior counsel with the International Finance Corporation in Washington, D.C. He holds LLM and SJD degrees from Harvard Law School, LLB and LLD degrees from the School of Law of the University of Buenos Aires, and is a member of the Argentine Federal, New York, District of Columbia, and United States Supreme Court bars. Horacio?
As Christine has indicated, we are on the third year of our annual lecture on international commercial arbitration by a distinguished practitioner and an expert on this in this area. The first lecturer was Jerry Axon. The second lecturer was Julian Liu QC. And today we have the very distinct honor of having Sir Vivian Ramsay as our lecturer. To describe the career of Vivian would take a long time, and I am really anxious to hear what he has to tell us. Let me start by the end, by the recent years. In November 2005, he was appointed as High Court Judge in the Queen's Bench Division, and in September 2007, he was appointed as Judge in Charge of the Technology and Construction Court. He received a knighthood on his appointment to High Court. Sir Vivian Ramsay, between 2003 and 2005, was head of Keating Chambers, the largest London set of barristers' chambers specializing in building, technology, IT, intellectual property, and associated commercial disputes. And I could go on and on and on, referring to the very distinguished career of Sir Vivian Ramsay. But let me mention what my personal experience has been. I have had the privilege to sit with Vivian in arbitration relating to the international construction industry. To see Sir Vivian at work is quite of an experience. You'll never see disappear his smile from his face, despite the most silliest argument put in front of him, and even if a hearing can become a long experience with boring witnesses and more boring experts. But not only that, he has savoir-faire skills. That is something that you do not learn at universities. That's something that you learn in the practice of the law, and in this case, in the practice of an arbitrator. He knows how to overcome difficult situations, how to smooth down animosities, and how to allow the hearing to go forward without creating additional irritation in the process of resolving the problems in front of him. And if you combine with that a thorough knowledge and experience on the merits of the case, and the fact that he is not only a lawyer, but he has a degree in engineering, I think that he is the epitome of the construction lawyer and the construction arbitrator. Without further ado, I let you with Sir Vivian Ramsay.
The question is really why I'm standing here today as a High Court judge talking about international arbitration. I feel somewhat ill-experienced in the recent past. I've just sat on a 109-day IT case involving, luckily, a US corporation and a public company in the UK. And all I was looking forward to during this summer was to be in Houston for 2 weeks on an international arbitration with Horacio and Carl Sapers. And guess what? The parties decided to settle it. It would have been one of those experiences during the vacation which would have put me back into international arbitration out of long-term litigation. So I can speak, I think, both with the experience of an international arbitrator. It's always the way in England that High Court judges, when they retire, become international arbitrators. I was an international arbitrator and I retired to become a High Court judge. But sometimes the two are not so different. Now, I could have come here, I have to say, I switched on the television in our hotel room the other night and I saw Tony Blair doing a chat show. I have to say, his performance was remarkable in many ways. He managed to ensure that he got through it without actually being completely lampooned. Although if you read the English press of today, you will find that he didn't really survive it at all. And the English press both going for Mr. Blair and Mr. Brown at the same time. Apparently there's a financial crisis out there. Well, let's, financial crisis or not, or perhaps because of financial crisis, establishing claims for damages, costs, and interest in international arbitration may become more topical when you see the actions of Lehman Brothers and one or two others within the market. But that's the farthest I can really make this topical. But in one of the most important points, I think, is in international arbitration, when you have the clients in front of you and you talk about liability and you talk about the difficulties of putting their case over, you've always got to remember that one of the major purposes from their point of view is not to give lawyers intellectual satisfaction at difficult arguments, but is in fact to establish a claim and obtain some payment or compensation. Now, in this lecture, I intend to investigate why, regrettably so often, the party who seeks to establish the claim faces a complex and difficult path and, in many cases, fails to establish the whole, or dare I say it, sometimes any of its claims. Now, lawyers very often concentrate, as I've said, rightly, on questions of liability, which, of course, are the necessary precursors to establishing any claim for damages. But, as one well-known English construction lawyer said, perhaps the first stage of all proceedings should be to determine the loss on the assumption that liability would be proved. Because on that basis, if people really saw what the financial claim was worth and how difficult it was to prove, there may never be any question of having to deal with liability. That's a bold approach, but having just dealt with a recent public-private partnership agreement in the UK where the claim was worth many millions of dollars, and in the end I awarded a few $100,000, perhaps it does make sense. Now, the title of this talk refers to damages, but I'll take that to refer generally to claims for payment and all sorts of compensation, typically under the terms of a contract. The link between liability and damages in complex cases, and that's what I'll concentrate on, is often a difficult path involving causation, an assessment of the loss suffered or the sum due. Because the major part of my experience has been in international arbitration involving complex technical disputes. That's the basis upon which I will draw examples. Now, whilst even in domestic arbitration or litigation, the assessment of damages has its challenge, the international element, I suggest, makes those challenges more difficult and at the same time adds its own challenges. There has to be some consideration, first of all, of course, of the legal principles which are to govern the relevant issues. At a simple level, this depends on whether the relevant matters of establishing claims are governed by the substantive law of the underlying contract or by some procedural law, either of the place of arbitration or one which is brought in by the contract. However, even to answer whether it's substantive law or procedural law often brings you into a situation where you have to deal with questions of conflict of law, which means that a decision has to be made as to which legal system you decide whether it is substantive law or procedural law. Now, unsurprisingly, in that plethora of difficulties, international arbitral tribunals seek for the comfort of what they describe as generally applicable laws in international commercial arbitration. That's adoption of such an uncertain concept is necessarily difficult for counsel who are approaching arbitration. How can you predict in advance what that particular group of three arbitrators is going to say are the generally applicable rules in international commercial arbitration? Now, of course, the path to establishing a claim for damages depends on legal concepts such as causation, foreseeability, mitigation, betterment. It depends on procedural matters such as burden of proof, assessment of the factual and expert evidence. It also depends on the interpretation of particular obligations under the underlying contract, and those include exclusion or limitation of liability provisions and such things as liquidated damages clauses. Now, one can see that even when you get through there, the two last things to decide are questions of interest and costs, which I suggest are just as important and raise as many different points. Now, what are those general principles of international commercial arbitration? In the general uncertainty which people dealing in international arbitration approach the subject with, you can say that there are some principles that are frequently referred to as generally applicable rules in establishing damages. I won't take your time to go through them in detail, but of course there is the first one, which is that the purpose of the damages is compensatory. It's intended to put the person in the same position as he would have been in, had he not sustained the wrong for which he's getting compensation. That leads, of course, to questions of betterment, so that he's not to be put in a better position. If you look at international principles, very often you find there is reference to the UNIDROIT principles, and those have a number of provisions in Article 7, Section 4, dealing with damages, including the general full compensationary principle. The second one is one which is derived from that wonderful English case of Hadley and Baxendale. You'll remember it's the case where a removal firm had to collect a rotor from a mill, and the great question was, were they told that that mill was there to make a profit? If they weren't, then there wouldn't be a natural loss arising. If they were told, then it was recoverable. And so it led to the two limbs, as it's described, of Hadley and Baxendale, as to foreseeability of damage, arising naturally or something which is expressly in the contemplation of the parties. And the third principle is the principle of mitigation. That is, a party has a limited duty to mitigate the loss which arises from it. All of those can be found both within all common law systems, civil law systems, and when you want to, you can look at the Unidra principles to find them. And one can see that what the first principle does, it establishes the compensatory approach, and the second and third principles, as matters of policy, put a limit on that compensatory approach. Now, you may think, well, those principles, we know those, that means that the going is simple. But let us look at causation. Whilst the way in which the concept is expressed, that of causation, varies in different legal systems, there's always, of course, a need for a claiming party to show that a breach caused a particular loss. As it's been said, causation is a mental concept generally based on inference or induction from uniformity of sequence between two events, that there is a causal connection between them. Now, if one has a simple case of a failure to deliver goods, then generally causation doesn't cause difficulty. But in complex international arbitrations, there are two concepts which cause immediate problems. The first is globality, a word perhaps which isn't in the dictionary but describes it well, and the second is concurrency. Globality arises because causation is rarely a simple matter of one cause and one effect. Much more likely, it is a multiplicity of causes and a multiplicity of effects coming out at the other end. Now, particularly in construction, IT and technology projects, where overall delay and disruption is caused by a multiplicity of events, and where causation depends on an extremely complex interaction between the consequences of various events and their results, there is a problem. That, of course, is a problem which an arbitrator in an international arbitration has to grapple with. What is the position where a party alleges 55 different causes and alleges at the end a delay of 2 years and $50 million? What is the international arbitrator to do when, in particular, as always happens in these cases, of all those causes which are alleged, some of them do not succeed, and on the other hand, the defending party puts forward a number of causes which one can see had some effect on the project. What do you do with that sort of global claim? The question is posed, and I'll in the end answer it, but it is a major problem of trying to assess what is the impact of a whole series of causes when you have one global effect. That is globality. Concurrency. It's a related problem. Because you have a number of causes of delay and disruption, which are alleged to be the fault of the defendant party, and at the same time, there are necessarily other matters which are either nobody's fault or they are the fault of the claimant party. What then happens? Take a simple example of a real example of a case of a power station I dealt with. You have a power station. The contractor is proceeding to complete the final activities, which are the testing of the generators, the very final part. The owner is about to take over, but the owner has to connect into the local electricity grid system, the grid. He has, unfortunately, had great difficulties in persuading the local Indonesian electricity authority to take the power. He is still in negotiation. The contractor at that stage sees himself in a wonderful position. all the delay which has been rolled up on his project is but nothing, because the last step is connection to the grid and the testing by the contractor of the connection to complete the works. The contractor therefore sees a rosy future of a claim coming up for delay to the project. Regrettably, the day before he thinks everything is going to be complete, one of the generators catches fire. That generator is destroyed, and it takes a great deal of time to get a new generator brought in. In the end, after a further 3 months delay, the contractor replaces the generator and completes the testing, and guess what? At the very same time, the owner makes available the delayed connection to the grid. Who is liable for the delay and disruption caused by the resulting delay of 3 months? Can the contractor make a claim? Is the contractor entitled to an extension of time for that time? And can he make a financial claim? I'll come to the answer in due course. But you can see that globality and concurrency mean that there is no simple answer to be made. Then one looks at the burden of proof. I always think, and still think as a judge, that the burden of proof reflects a view that you only look at burden of proof if really the cogency of the evidence isn't very good. Where a tribunal starts to look at questions of burden of proof, you know that the matter is difficult if you're a claimant party. But it is true that the claimant has the burden of proof. But one always has to remember that when it comes to establishing a mitigation, when it comes to challenging foreseeability, there is a burden on the other party. There is also, inevitably in cases, an evidential burden. The evidential burden clearly starts with a claimant, but if it shows that it has suffered the loss, then the evidential burden by evidence or cross-examination goes on to the other party. So you have to take into account the burden of proof. Then you've got the problem of assessing factual and expert evidence. In international arbitration, one has to realize, as counsel presenting a case, that there is no certainty as to how that tribunal will deal with factual and expert evidence. A well-honed American expert giving evidence before a Swiss tribunal may find that he is challenged on everything that he thought would be accepted as a given before a domestic tribunal. But before that, one has to consider factual evidence. An initial question, which is posed in a lot of international cases, is what is the attitude of the tribunal to documents? Does a document speak for itself? Do you have to prove a document to be a genuine document? Now, anybody who is sitting in this room who has had recent experience of dealing with an arbitration within the former Soviet states will, I think, have had an experience of challenging the fundamentals of the genuineness of almost every document. There can be few arbitrations in former Soviet states where you produce a document which has a signature to a witness, and the witness is asked a question, is this your document? They say no. The next question is that your signature? Yes, it is. Is it not therefore your document? No, it isn't. Somebody must have made up that document and put my signature on the bottom of it. Now, if you're in a domestic arbitration, I will suggest that that is a rare outcome, that you have every single document being challenged as to truth, every single meeting challenged as to truth. And in those situations, you have to know what is the attitude of the tribunal to challenges to the genuineness of a document. The second is, what about proof of the facts in that document? Nowadays, there are plenty of systems where you still have every document being provided by a witness as an exhibit during the course of proceedings. Now, I'm glad to say the more usual approach in international arbitration and increasingly in civil cases in all other jurisdictions is for the tribunal to admit all evidence and deal with it on the basis that any challenge can be made to it at any time, and in the end the tribunal will assess the weight to be given to it. But you've got to know in establishing your claim what the approach will be of the tribunal to facts in documents and in witness statements. The use of expert evidence is, of course, widespread, particularly on quantum claims. I will suggest that is where people decide they're going to get an expert. Unfortunately, many people hand over to the expert the total job of establishing the quantum of a claim. That, I would suggest, is to misuse the basis upon which expert evidence is generally given. And it has some devastating effects. I recall an arbitration in which the expert had done all of the investigation, and he was the person who gave all of the evidence on all of the quantum. And the tribunal adopted an approach which said, we don't want to hear from the expert as to what the quantum is. What we want to hear is from the people in the company who can tell me what all these accounting documents are. We don't want to hear the expert's view on what he has found as a result of his investigation. Primarily, it's a matter of fact, they said. It is not a matter of expertise. Therefore, the approach of the tribunal to expert evidence can vary enormously between jurisdictions. There are, of course, advantages in having experts dealing with quantum matters. First of all, it is a subject where very often an expert view on quantum is essential. The second aspect is that in this day and age, expert meetings are ordered by most international arbitrators, and in those expert meetings, the experts can narrow the issues and agree the quantum, and in my experience, that is one of the major advantages of having experts. But as I've said, a major disadvantage is the expert cannot make good a lack of factual evidence underlying the claim, and if he tries to do so, he can damage his position in the arbitration. Now, let's look then at the detail of the presentation of the claim, and I'm going to take two examples. The first is the favourite delay and disruption claim. The first requirement for presenting any claim is, of course, a proper analysis of the facts. As I've said, there's a natural tendency in relation to delay and disruption claims to assume that the task is impossible and therefore to avoid any proper analysis. Some causative events are bound to be better than others in the sense that they are stronger in terms of liability and more likely to lead to an inference that there was some substantial degree of delay or cost that has been caused by that event. So instead of the global claim, my suggestion is that what has to be done is a much more careful analysis of the facts rather than the encyclopedia of events that have happened on a project, which you so often find on these matters, with on the other end of the scale a large delay and a large loss and expense claim. Now, the analysis of the facts, I suggest, can often be simplified by dividing up the project into discrete parts. This may be a division based on particular areas of the project. It may be based on particular activities or trades or particular time periods. It may be a combination of all of those. But what it allows that analysis is the case to be presented to the tribunal in a logical manner to allow the tribunal to understand the process and the evidence so that they are not overwhelmed by the complexity and in so doing accede to the fact that a large claim is likely to fail. Now, the use of sophisticated computer-generated analyses often, I regret, conceals everything but the end result. And in using it, computer analyses in that way, parties so often end up with failure. I'm sure most of the people who have sat as arbitrators or counsel will be aware of the many volumes which are presented to arbitrators which contain the output of some sort of analysis which has been carried out to prove delay and or disruption. Those volumes, regrettably, often stand unopened in international arbitrations. And the reason is that the analysis is something which people, arbitrators, even counsel, find it very difficult to grapple with. I well remember some years ago doing a case for a very distinguished client, the Aga Khan. He, luckily, had unlimited resources in people who he employed. The other side, a major UK contractor who took the project over from an American contractor who was thrown off the site, this large English contractor decided they would produce the most sophisticated analysis imaginable. And there it was laid on the table of the Sultan of Brunei's suite at a hotel in Paris where the international arbitration was taking place, with the sort of flourish which one would expect the tribunal to say, ah, it is all proved. What they didn't know was the Sultan of Brunei had managed to have within his suite a bathroom which was the deliberating room for the arbitrators. And there is nothing worse than having the international arbitrators going into the bathroom to deliberate because they resonate with comments. And the first comment which came out from the chairman of the tribunal was, what on earth are we going to do with this? Luckily, the Aga Khan had thought of the solution. He had 12 people go through the whole of this detailed analysis. And instead of just looking at the end result, they had done a detailed analysis of what actually was shown by this. And unsurprisingly, they found that the whole of the period of delay on this hospital project had been caused by the late delivery of one cabinet to one of the 600 bedrooms in the hospital. And the reason that had been done was because there was a dependency between the completion of the joinery and the next activity, and because the joinery had been delayed, albeit one cabinet, the dependency and the logic had not been changed, and that, I am glad to say, was a case where, acting for the Aga Khan, one was able to make the submission that we have conceded 3 days' extension of time for this project, and the tribunal gave them 3 days' extension of time. That is obviously an example, but it does show the underlying difficulty of using a sophisticated analysis which is not properly analysed from a factual point of view. Another difficulty is that so often approaches develop over time. We all know that the initial claim is put together often on a fairly broad brush basis. But it's never quite jettisoned, because those are the figures the client would like to recover. As other forms of analysis are done, they are not there to supersede the initial analysis, but very often the tribunal is faced with three different approaches, and they are given the general spiel at the end, which says, you can see that this approach comes up with 56 weeks, this approach comes up with 40 weeks, this approach comes up with 42 weeks. And that shows consistently that there is a claim for at least 42 weeks. The problem, I suggest, in experience, shows that the greater the number of different approaches, the easier it is for the opponent to pick holes and inconsistencies within the approach. The 42 weeks will show that all the delay was caused by one matter, the 46 weeks by something else, the 56 weeks by another matter. And in that way, frequently, regrettably, the claims fail. So what I would suggest is, instead of those global claims, it is far better to choose some of the more cogent reasons which can be laid before the arbitrator, which can be explained in fact to the arbitrator, and that is a much more successful way than going down the globality route. I recently had to do an appeal against an arbitration award, and it was an arbitration award which had to do with London Underground. It was a new system going into London Underground. The parties had, the claimant party had adopted a global approach. But luckily, right at the end of one of the documents, they had said, and of course, delay in the power supply also caused delay. The arbitrator found, first of all, that none of the analyses which had been done, computer-generated or any other analysis, was appropriate. But what he did find was that there had obviously been delay, because if you can't put power to a system, you can't get it up and running. And he based his whole decision on the fact that there was a delay to getting power. I upheld his award because the matter was pleaded with sufficient detail for the other party to know that they had to deal with that allegation, and indeed they did so. But what it emphasized is, if only that party had concentrated more effort on allegations which were such as delayed power supply, two or three others, they would have spent much less time and money in the analysis and stood a very much better chance of success. That's delay and disruption. Loss of profits. Loss of profits is, I suggest, the other bête noire of international commercial arbitration. They often arise because there is invariably delay, disruption, termination, and the loss of profits. Now, the question, first of all, is how do you assess loss of profits that a party would have made on a given project? And you find that approaches vary. First of all, there may be a projection on past profits. A company may say, in the past, we have made an average profit on all our projects of 25%. Well, 5%. Well, 3.5%. But you may base it on that. The second way is to have an estimated profit, the price included, a 5% profit allowance. And the third, and more difficult than even those, particularly where you have a new company with a new endeavor, is really to have purely an accountant's projection of what might be a future profit. Now, all of those methods have difficulties. The first, trying to predict from past profits, it's unfailing experience, particularly in the financial market, that past profits are no indication of future profits. And certainly, you may be able to draw some conclusion if the profits of a company have been made in the more recent past, though I find it difficult even to say that today, that may be a closer guidance. But often, as I've indicated, the profits come from a whole number of projects with different parts of the company, different types of project, different risks, and there can be a very wide fluctuation. So that the average figure may be made up of some projects which have made 50% profit down to ones which have made 100% losses. The second approach assumes the prediction which has been made at the time of the contract is an accurate prediction which would have been made out at the end of the project. Now, necessarily, these claims arise on projects where things have gone wrong. And it makes the relationship between the prediction and reality normally very difficult to maintain. And the final approach is particularly difficult, to try and use some accountant's prediction, as the underlying assumptions are usually derived from a market sector or from similar projects, all of which can usually be distinguished on the facts. Now, the second problem which arises in loss of profits is where the loss will be sustained, not just over a short period, immediately after the facts giving rise to the dispute, but instead will be suffered over an extended period many years into the future. For instance, what is the predicted revenue stream based on oil, coal, or ore prices for 25 years? And what are the costs to be set against that over that similar period? Those are all necessary parts of a calculation if you're to set off what the profit will be over a period of 25 years. The third problem is very often knowing what the overall impact will be. Now, take the case of an oil pipeline, an actual case, where an Italian firm provided certificates for undersea pipelines, for an oil pipeline. And unfortunately, it was discovered that the people who were providing the certificates had never actually seen the pipes in the factory. And so there were uncertified pipes on this underwater pipeline. The decision had to be made by the oil company to replace the whole of the oil pipeline. And it meant that a number of years' oil revenue were lost as a result. Now, the oil, of course, hopefully, still is in the ground. And it means that in the end, the revenue from the oil of that 1 year will come in at the end of the project. Now, what is lost in terms of it is a profit for that current year, but of course there is then a gain in the profit for the last year. And the question is, well, when is that last year? Is it off to 10, 25, or 50 years? And how is that to be assessed? Sometimes it's more easy. If you've got a design, a finance, build, and operate contract, you may not have the same problems because you've got a 25 or 30-year concession period, and you therefore lose a year. But what do you lose? Do you lose the year at the beginning? Do you lose the year at the end? Or do you lose a year in the middle? I suggest that all of that shows that loss of profits is a particularly difficult way of having to analyze a loss. Now, there are two other things that have to be added in. There's the exclusion and limitation of liability clauses. Those have to be interpreted not only under the national law, but under the international law. What does direct damage mean in the law of Pakistan? What is consequential loss in the law of Sudan? It is very often difficult to find what is the meaning of a well-drafted American or English limitation of liability clause when you come to apply it to local law. Equally, liquidated damages clauses are often relied upon by a party to avoid all of the uncertainty of trying to produce complex calculations to prove loss. The common lawyers, of course, are keen to try and show that it's some form of a penalty, that it wasn't a properly assessed sum, so that it didn't represent, at the time it was made, a genuine pre-estimate of the damages which might be suffered. But in many civil law countries, where a civil code applies, and indeed, if the tribunal applies UNIDROIT Article 7413, which everybody will know, there is an ability for the court to revisit liquidated damages clauses. Under French law, they can do it if it's patently excessive or ridiculously low. Under UNIDROIT, you can do it if it's grossly excessive in relation to the harm resulting from the non-performance and other circumstances. So far, I suggest that when you go into international arbitration and you try to produce the similar calculations, the similar assessment of damages as you would for a normal domestic arbitration, there are a multitude of difficulties which lie in your path. Now, what about the approach to assessment? Now, you can see I've set out the challenges. What then are the ways in which international tribunals approach the question? There is a wonderful English case called Chaplin and Hicks. It's a case of a loss of opportunity. It arose in this way. An actor decided he needed some attractive actresses to work in his theatre. And instead of just having a casting session, he decided that he would use a newspaper advertisement and put their faces in the newspaper and have people vote, because that would encourage people then to come along to his theatre to watch his plays. There was one of the actresses who managed to get through all of the selection process. The 300 sent their photos in, 50 were put in the paper, and one of them came within the top three. But of those 50, there were only 12 places for actresses. Now, what unfortunately he did was he changed the date of the final interviews. And he changed the date of the final interviews and sent out a letter that day saying that the day after tomorrow, the interviews will take place. Regrettably, this actress was in Scotland. And although the letter arrived at her London address, and the postal services were so good in those days that by the following evening it had been delivered to Dundee, it was too late for her to make the appointment. The question was, how do you assess what loss she's suffered as a result of not attending the beauty contest and therefore not having the opportunity of becoming an actress in that play? You can imagine a number of different tests that the court might have applied. The court might have asked for all 50 to come and carried out its own assessment of what the chances are that she would succeed. But instead, they decided to make a lump sum allowance in those days of, in those days, 1911, of £100 sterling, something like $200, I would guess, by today's days. Now, the question is, what was the approach to be taken? Because, of course, what was said in that case is really, you just cannot make any assessment. And as the judge said, it was said that the plaintiff's chance of winning a prize turned on such a number of contingencies that it was impossible for anyone, even after arriving at a conclusion that the plaintiff had lost her opportunity by the breach, to say that there was an assessable value of that loss. What he said was that in such a case, a jury or a judge must do the best they can, and it may be that the amount of their verdict will really be a matter of guesswork. The same was said in the Canadian case of Wood and the Grand Valley Railway, where a number of people in the town were sold possibility of contributing to a bond for the railway company to build a railway to their town. They failed to build the railway, and naturally the citizens of the town sued. And what was said in that case, it was clearly impossible, under the facts of this case, to estimate with anything approaching mathematical accuracy the damages sustained by the plaintiffs. But it seems to me to be clearly laid down by judges that such an impossibility cannot relieve the wrongdoer of the necessity of paying damages for his breach of contract. And he said, and it's even if it's a matter of guesswork, there must be a decision by the jury or judge. Interestingly, I suggest that even in the Unidroit principle 7.4.3, certainty of harm, there is the same principle laid out. It says compensation is due only for harm, including future harm, that is established with a reasonable degree of certainty. Compensation may be due for the loss of a chance in proportion to the probability of its occurrence. Where the amount of damages cannot be established with a sufficient degree of certainty, the assessment is at the discretion of the court. Now, this approach, I suggest, is indicative of a pragmatic approach to the assessment of damages, which regrettably is not always followed in international arbitration. One has to remember that the approach to be taken by a particular tribunal will depend on the view of the tribunal as to the merits of the underlying dispute. And also, I regret, experience shows that it depends on the inclination or ability of the tribunal to carry out the necessary investigation, assessment, or guesswork. Often it leads to the tribunal coming to the conclusion, rather too easily, that it should dismiss the claim because the damages cannot be established with the degree of certainty which is thought to be appropriate, or the damages are said all too often to be speculative. Those two reasons, I suggest, are relied on too readily. It may be that the presentation, as I've indicated, isn't good enough for the tribunal to be able to understand what the whole basis of the claim is. But if a party can show that it suffered an actionable wrong, whether in contract or tort, the tribunal should seek to make an award of damages. The fact that certainty isn't possible, or that the exercise requires the tribunal to speculate about outcomes, should not, I suggest, deprive a party from some form of recovery. There are two cases which indicate, perhaps, the wide divergence that you may suffer if you are in international arbitration. On the one hand, there's the ICSID case of Okoven and Venezuela, the Venezuela Bridge Project, which was a 30-year concession agreement. For various reasons, the bridge was never built, and the contractors, or the concession company, sued for a loss of profit. The tribunal based itself on Venezuelan Supreme Court decisions, but stated that those were consistent with the practice of international tribunals. And they said international tribunals have often dismissed claims for lost profits in cases of breach of contract on the ground that they were speculative and that the claimant had not proven with a sufficient degree of certainty that the project would have resulted in a profit. They therefore held that the claim by the concession company was not made out. At the other end of the scale is a case between KBC and PLN, which was concerning a geothermal power project in Indonesia, which proved unnecessary because of the 1997 downturn in Asian markets. The tribunal in that case awarded KBC both the expense it had incurred entirely and also lost profits. It seems to me that, as Lewis Wells argued in his article, questioning the damages awarded, there was indeed double dipping, because the party was made whole by having all of its expenditure made good, and also it made a resounding profit on top of it. Now that, I suggest, shows two divergent approaches. One which rejects, the other which overcompensates. But somewhere in the middle is an approach which I suggest should be more common. In Paul Galinas's article in the ICC dossier on establishing claims, he refers to the French jurisdiction in which judges, when faced with difficulties of quantification, will make what is called, in translation, a sovereign appreciation. And in doing so, they fix damages by making a lump sum award. And Paul Galinas says, which they do because they've decided not to expend any effort on quantification. But perhaps that principle could be applied more widely, where there are cases where clearly there is a claim, but the principles of quantification have made it difficult to establish. Once you've quantified the claim, there are two other aspects which have to be considered. One is interest. Interest often is, especially on contracts which have taken a long time and on arbitrations which have taken even longer, can be a significant part or percentage of the overall claim. Indeed, it can exceed it. There are issues in interest which are fascinating and are dealt with, again, in the ICC dossier. But substantially, they turn around the question of, well, is any interest awardable under this international contract or not? Saudi Arabia the law of Saudi Arabia says no, no interest at all. In other countries such as Kuwait and Sudan, there is an ability to have some commercial interest on commercial transactions. But arbitral tribunals always have to guard against awarding interest in such countries because if the court in that country disagrees with the award of interest, the whole award will not be enforced. And therefore, you've got to be on very certain ground if you're a claimant party and you wish to have your award enforced in those countries. There are also difficulties of assessing what is the rate of interest. Should it be interest which is simple, and should it be compound? There are also related questions on calculation of loss of profit claims, discounting an award of profit. Supposing you've got profit running over 15 or more years, what is the position in terms of the profit you get for year 15, which you are getting now instead of in year 15? And very often, experts will agree that after 15 years, the present net value of something which will be earned in 15 years is almost nil. Finally, in the quantification of claims, we come to costs. For lawyers, those are some of the most important aspects. And in international arbitration, compared to a lot of domestic claims, costs can be recoverable. It is important, though, that a party in international arbitration has very little knowledge of how the tribunal is going to approach the question of costs at the end of the day. Costs, like interest, can often be larger, certainly, than the sum awarded, if not than the sum claimed. And in those circumstances, you need to know what principles the tribunal are going to set out as the basis on which they will allow a recovery. Also, you'll need to know how they're going to assess the costs. Are they going to allow contingency fees? Are they going to allow hourly rates? Are they going to allow certain heads of cost for clients, witnesses, and experts? In international arbitration, there is, I suggest, this major difficulty of knowing in advance what approach a tribunal will take. If you have a Swiss chairman, a European, and an American co-arbitrator, to try and predict in advance what they will do about a bill for $10 million of costs is uncertain. Some parties try to ascertain from the tribunal at an early stage where they stand on costs. But because the question of costs is a matter of discretion for the tribunal, it is a very rare tribunal that in the initial stages will give any indication at all. English and other common law jurisdictions have developed methods of cost protection by writing without prejudice savers to costs letters in order to try and ensure they have the costs at the end of the day. The concept is that you make an offer of costs to the other side, saying, for instance, that we will pay you $10 million, this is the defendant does so, $10 million, and we will pay your costs up to today. But if you get less than $10 million, we will go to the tribunal and say we ought to have all of our costs from these days, even if you get $8 million. And that way of cost protection, which has developed in a lot of Commonwealth and common law jurisdictions, is an important aspect in international arbitration, which is very often not complied with. And for the sake of a letter which goes to the other side and is only shown to the tribunal at the end of the proceedings, a party can often recover a large amount of costs. But like everything in international arbitration, you have to remember that the letter you write may be construed by reference to a system of law which is not the one you have gone with. For instance, in former Soviet states, the without prejudice rule does not ride unless it's a communication which comes from a lawyer in certain circumstances. And the last thing you want to do is to let the tribunal know in advance what your offer has been for various obvious reasons. So in total, what I would suggest in international arbitration of complex claims is that, first of all, there are complex and difficult issues even in domestic cases. They are made far worse and far more difficult by international arbitration because of the uncertainty of knowing where the arbitral tribunals stand on procedural matters and where the substantive law will lead. But in international arbitration, that is part of the challenge. And so far as establishing claims in international arbitration are concerned, I would suggest that it's the fascination of those uncertainties which make it a challenge. Thank you very much.
Let me, in addition to thanking our speaker who has really enlightened us on a difficult topic, you're now invited for drinks outside, and thank you very much for coming.